Listening to the AT Tapes, a podcast from the Journal of Athletic Training. The goal of this podcast is to interview researchers and clinicians on current topics facing athletic trainers and discuss how we can utilize best practices to improve patient outcomes. My name is Lizzie Hibbard, and I will be your host for this podcast. I'm a faculty member in the athletic training program at the University of Alabama, and I have a research interest in shoulder and elbow injury prevention in youth overhead athletes. You can follow me on Twitter at EE Hibbard. Before getting started on today's episode, I wanted to remind everyone that all content from JAT is open access, meaning it is free of charge to all readers thanks to funding from the National Athletic Trainers Association. This month, the Journal of Athletic Training released a special thematic issue on sports specialization. The goal of this special edition is to encourage readers to consider sports specialization in youth sports as it pertains to short-term and long-term physical health, psychosocial well-being and burnout, and healthcare. This issue also strives to inform public policy with a high level of evidence. In today's episode, we have Dr. Eric Post from San Diego State University joining us to discuss issues related to sports specialization, and specifically his article in the special issue discussing differences in coaches' emergency preparedness and medical coverage between high school and club sports. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get started with talking about sports specialization, I want to ask you a few questions about your background. So can you start out by telling us your educational background and how you became interested in this research area?
Sure, yeah. So I did my undergrad in athletic training at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. From there, I went on and did my master's degree at Illinois State University in athletic training and worked there as a GA with their college baseball team. And that's when I first started getting involved with research. I was working with Dr. Kevin Laudner at Illinois State looking at pitching biomechanics. But really my interest was growing in kind of overuse injuries within baseball specifically, but across different sports. And so I went back to the University of Wisconsin in Madison and did my PhD in kinesiology under the mentorship of Dave Bell. And that's where I really became involved in kind of the sports specialization research.
So now as you think about your research area and sort of your research trajectory, what would you describe as your sort of niche?
I think, you know, for me, what I'm really focused in is more in terms of the factors that are causing the increasing trend towards sports specialization. So there's been a lot of research on the physical consequences, specifically overuse injury. But really what I found myself being more interested in and moving towards is, you know, how do the other stakeholders involved in youth sports, parents, coaches, even the kids themselves, you know, why are they deciding to specialize or, you know, push their child to specialize? What do they perceive as the benefits and consequences of doing so?
So all those years ago at Wisconsin, why did you decide to become an athletic trainer?
I was thinking about this. I don't really know. I don't have like a good story of why I got interested. You know, I played sports growing up, as hard as that can be to believe. But I knew I wanted to be involved in medicine somehow. And so I was just sampling classes and majors at the University of Wisconsin, was kind of in that undecided major category for a long time. And then took some of the athletic training courses and got really interested in it and kind of fell into it from there.
Well, it seems like it's worked out for you. And as you're young in your professional career, or you are young in your professional career, but can you touch on some of the highlights of your accomplishments so far to date?
I think for me, really, the highlights in terms of the research world has been a lot of the sports specialization work that I was involved with at Wisconsin with Dave Bell and Tim McGuine, Allison Brooks. A lot of that work that kind of was some of the early papers looking at sports specialization and overuse injury in youth sports. And then more recently, now that I'm out in California, a big highlight for me has been working with the CATA and their government affairs committee we've put together. I've helped them develop a database of 95% of high schools in California that sponsor high school sports. And so we have data on, you know, whether they have an athletic trainer, whether the athletic trainer is certified or not, since California doesn't have any regulation on the profession. And so we're using that data to help support the push for a licensure bill out here in California. So I think that's kind of one of the things right now that I'm really excited about.
Well, that's great that you're doing research and making a lot of contributions to the profession beyond just your research and teaching. So thanks for sharing that with us. So as we get started today with actually talking about sports specialization, I think it's important to start by defining the terminology. So just making sure that everyone's on the same page with the words that we're using. So can you start out by defining both sports specialization and then early age sports specialization?
Yeah, so sports specialization, the current definition that we're working from is from the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine, and it's year-round intensive training in a single sport at the exclusion of other sports. So, you know, it's not necessarily just playing one sport, being a single sport athlete. It's doing it year-round and really focusing in that sport to the exclusion of other sports. And in terms of early age sports specialization, you know, I think that's an area that we don't necessarily know as much as maybe we think we know in that area. There's a lot of gaps in the literature. So there's a lot of questions still remaining about, you know, what is the appropriate age to start specializing? When you look at kind of the sport development, skill development literature, it really pushes more towards kind of early sampling. So pre-adolescence, sampling multiple sports, multiple activities before eventual specialization in kind of mid to late adolescence. But, you know, I would guess that there's a lot of variability to that based on the actual sport that's being talked about. So in something like gymnastics, early specialization may be more necessary for peak performance as opposed to a sport like basketball or soccer, where you can specialize at a later age and still transfer a lot of skills from other sports that you've developed.
So since you're kind of talking about that, can you talk a little bit about some of the potential benefits of specialization? Or like you already mentioned gymnastics as potentially a sport where you need to specialize early. And then after that, we'll talk about maybe some of these consequences, but I think you bring up a point that there is maybe some perceived benefits and some actual benefits of specialization.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think like anything in life, there's pros and cons, right? And so I think the major perceived benefit that's viewed by youth athletes and by parents, and that we've shown in some surveys of youth athletes and parents, is that overwhelmingly, kids and parents view specialization as beneficial for getting better at their sport. Okay, so they think if they specialize and play year-round, that's going to help them get a lot better at their sport and eventually play at an elite level. Now, whether or not that's true is probably skill dependent and sport domain specific. You know, so for those sports, like I said, that need that peak performance at an earlier age, gymnastics, figure skating, maybe specialization is more necessary from an earlier age to be able to hit that window for peak performance. But what a lot of kind of the skill development literature has shown, and people like Jean Côté in Canada, that his research really shows that what parents perceive as the 10,000 hour rule, you know, you need to invest a certain amount of time to become an expert. That's very heavily dependent on the skill domain and the specific task that you're performing. So for something that's very repeatable and technical, something like playing an instrument, or golf, or you know, a very individualized skill, yes, you know, a high amount of specific practice within the domain will help you get better. But you know, what Jean Côté has shown is that there's these alternative pathways to skill development, something he calls a developmental model of sport participation, where you have this early sampling period that focuses on deliberate play, sampling various activities, and then eventual specialization late in adolescence. And so there's a huge transfer of skills that still allows those individuals to reach elite status. And so there's been research showing that when you look at collegiate athletes across a number of sports, professional athletes, a lot of those athletes tend to follow that pathway of sampling a lot of different activities at a young age before eventually specializing and choosing their kind of their final sport relatively late in their athletic career.
So it sounds like the perceived benefits that a lot of athletes and parents have is not really supported in the literature and for a lot of sports.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, it's not necessarily supported for, you know, the most popular team-based sports. So things like basketball, soccer, football, volleyball, not necessarily supported for those sports. But like I said, there are specific sports. The more individual the sport is, the more kind of where it's in a controlled environment where there's not a lot of outside influences on your skill execution besides your individual skill level, those sports are more catered towards really that intense focus specialization from an early age.
So now let's talk about the flip side of that, of what are the consequences of sport specialization and particularly early age sport specialization, both physical, psychosocial, all, kind of across all those different areas.
Yeah, so the physical consequences, I think, is what we have the most literature supporting. And so it's been a pretty consistent finding from a number of different research groups now over numerous studies that high levels of specialization are associated with overuse injuries. And so when you look at both lower extremity and upper extremity sports, there seems to be kind of this consistent finding that kids who are really focused in one sport and doing that year round, whether it's due to the repetition of a same movement pattern or just due to the sheer volume of doing something over and over again, it definitely seems to be linked with overuse injury. In terms of the psychosocial consequences, I think that is a little bit more in the theoretical realm right now. I think, you know, the evidence is not necessarily wide scale that it's going to be detrimental in terms of things like burnout from sports or mental health consequences. I think there's a lot of studies from what I can tell, a lot of research is starting to grow in this area and a lot of people are interested in looking at it. But I don't necessarily know that there's overwhelming support in the literature right now that supports what people are anecdotally reporting as, you know, being true.
So you've already alluded to the fact that there's been a significant increase in sports specialization that's occurred, and you're seeing more and more kids specialize. So do you have any data to support that, or is there any sort of rates relative to the changes in sports specialization, or is that all anecdotal?
I think that again is mostly anecdotal. So it's one of these things where it starts, you know, a lot of our research that I was involved with at Wisconsin started with the team physicians, you know, saying things like we're seeing more and more kids that are coming in with these type of injuries. There has been some data to show, you know, out of the American Sports Medicine Institute that their rates of Tommy John surgery are rising among younger and younger populations. So some of that data, you know, anecdotally supports the idea that some things are happening within youth sports that have not necessarily happened in the past. In terms of actually measuring sports specialization rates over time, that data doesn't exist to my knowledge, but it sure seems to be, if not becoming more common now, it's definitely something that people are talking about more and more kind of within the general public and lay media and just within the scientific community.
So I think trying to understand the culture of youth sports is a challenge for a lot of reasons, but particularly as it relates to sports specialization, what are some of the factors that you think contribute to this change in the culture of youth sports, where it seems like some kids feel like you have to specialize?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, like I said earlier, I think that's where most of my interest is kind of going towards, is trying to figure out those reasons why. I think just, and I don't have data to support this, but just kind of thinking out loud, I think there's been a lot of high profile cases of successful early sports specializers that came, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s. So you got Tiger Woods, the Williams sisters, these cases of athletes that really were high profile in the media and specialized at a very young age, and that probably gained a lot of understanding in the public consciousness of being the route towards being a successful athlete. You also have the 10,000 hour rules, which I mentioned earlier, which became popularized through one of Malcolm Gladwell's books and became really kind of an idea that when we survey parents and talk to them, you know, the vast majority have heard of this idea that you need to do something over and over again to become an expert at it. And so I think there's, you know, a combination of different things that have happened, you know, in the general consciousness of the public that have raised this idea that the way to be successful in sports is to focus on it very early, to the exclusion of everything else, and really devote your time towards deliberate practice within that domain. And this has kind of coincided with youth sports increasingly resembling professional sports. And so we have, you know, a lot of big money involved in youth sports in terms of tournaments and showcases and year-round travel teams and participation and schedules that are just as long or if not longer than professional sports schedules. So I think there's been a lot of things that have kind of happened at the same time to kind of create this the current youth sports culture.
So you brought up club sport or travel sport participation, which segues nicely into talking a little bit more about your paper from this special issue. So we know that club sports come with significant challenges in ensuring that there's adequate medical care, because a lot of these are independent associations, or they might not have the resources or the knowledge of what athletic trainers are or other recommendations that either the NATA or other organizations has put out for emergency management and injury prevention. So in the special issue, you published an article called A Comparison of Emergency Preparedness Between High School Coaches and Club Sport Coaches, Will you start out by telling us a little bit about where this idea came from and who you ended up with the participants, or who ended up as the participants in that study?
Yeah, so, you know, we had done a lot of projects through Tim McGuine's high school athlete network that he has in Wisconsin. And so from doing those surveys of high school athletes, what we found was that a huge percentage, exactly half, so about 50% of the high school athletes we were surveying, indicated to us that they also played a club sport in addition to their high school sport, and on top of what they were already doing as part of their high school sport participation. So that really raised the interest with us in terms of looking at, you know, what are these club teams doing with regards to medical coverage and emergency preparedness? You know, there's been a ton of attention paid to increasing medical coverage by athletic trainers at the high school setting, ensuring emergency preparedness standards at the high school sports setting. But really the club sports setting is kind of a complete unknown. And so if there really is this huge population of athletes that are participating in club sports nowadays across the United States, we thought it would be, you know, really interesting to look at what exactly is happening from a medical coverage and emergency preparedness standard in that setting. And so what we ended up doing is we worked with the Michigan High School Athletic Association, and we recruited high school coaches in Michigan. They had to be a coach of a high school volleyball, soccer, or basketball team. And we compared those coaches to club coaches that we recruited that were only club coaches, and they had to have coached high school or high school aged club athletes in soccer, volleyball, or basketball. So we ended up with 497 high school coaches, and we compared them to 272 club coaches, and compared, you know, who typically provides medical care at their practices and competitions. And also we compared a number of emergency preparedness variables. So such as, do you have an AED at your practice venue? Do you have an AED at your competition venue? Are you aware of the emergency action plan at your practice or at your competition venue? You know, are you required to have first aid or CPR training as part of your coaching responsibilities?
So I want to talk a little bit about your results from this. And there was a lot of information in that paper. So I encourage everyone to find that in the special issue so you can read all of the results. But if you'll start out by touching on some of the demographic characteristics and the comparison between the high school and club coaches and some of the unique differences in those two groups.
Yeah, so overall, you know, we had our high school coaches were a large proportion of them were also teachers at the school. Obviously, I think this, you know, a lot of people know this to be the case, but a lot of the high school coaches also taught at their schools, whereas the club coaches, a larger proportion of them, their primary employment was through that club setting or through another outside employment, right? So they were not necessarily teachers employed by the school. You know, a very small proportion of them were also teachers. So that's kind of the main demographic difference we saw. The distribution of sport within the different groups was roughly equal. So, you know, there weren't huge differences between club and high school in terms of the sport distribution. Some minor differences, but nothing too major there. And then education level, again, you know, the majority of our coaches in both categories held bachelor's degrees. So, you know, these are groups that are roughly comparable in terms of the breakdown, but the main difference we saw there was in terms of their employment status. You know, the high school coaches obviously are going to be tend towards more of them are going to be employed by the high school as a teacher as well.
So then more to the purpose of the project was looking at this medical coverage and emergency preparedness. So you talk a little bit about some of the results of the difference in medical coverage between high school and club teams.
Yeah, so basically what we saw across the board, whether it was medical coverage or emergency preparedness, was that there's huge differences that we observed between the high school setting and the club setting. And so when we looked at high school coaches and medical coverage, 31% of the high school coaches reported that athletic trainers were responsible for immediate medical care during practice, compared to just 9% of club coaches. Okay, so 31% versus 9%, say an athletic trainer is the primary medical caregiver during practice. When you look at during a competition, you got about 60% of high school coaches saying that an athletic trainer is the primary medical provider during competitions, compared to 30% of club coaches. We also looked at how much the athletic trainer was available during practices and competitions, some of the time, none of the time, almost all the time. We saw that 3/4, so 76% of the club coaches indicated that an athletic trainer was never present at their practices. So, you know, 76% of the time, There's no athletic trainer at any of these club coaches' practices when their team is practicing. And that's compared to just 46% of high school coaches telling us the same thing. So when you think about the three sports we looked at, volleyball, soccer, basketball, when you look at the injury risk involved with those sports, it's not necessarily something like football, but still we'd like to see, an athletic trainer present at practices more than, 24% of the time in the case of club coaches. So it's really kind of low levels of medical coverage overall for the club setting.
And then in relation to emergency preparedness, there has been a big push in high schools about having more prepared EAPs, more training in the schools. And so there's definitely been a movement of that in the high schools. But what did you find in your research of how that compared between high school coaches and then club coaches?
Yeah, this is really where we saw kind of the most drastic differences between the two settings. Like you said, there's been this push to make sure that things at the secondary school level, emergency preparedness is improved, medical coverage is improved. But from our experience, the club's sports setting is still kind of the Wild West when it comes to these things without any sort of regulations on them. And so we saw, 84% of high school coaches were aware of the emergency action plan for their practice venue compared to just half of club coaches. 90% of high school coaches reported having AED at practice compared to 60% of club coaches. And really the big one was in terms of CPR training. So 99% of the high school coaches were required to have CPR training compared to just 34% of club coaches. So there's these huge gaps that we see in terms of the emergency preparedness, whether it's EAPs, AED availability, or just basic, CPR first aid skills between those high school coaches and the club coaches. And to touch on the CPR and first aid training, in both settings, most of the time the coach was reported to be the primary, the person responsible for immediate medical care when there is an injury at practice. So the athletic trainer in the high school setting, they might be back in the athletic training room providing treatments, but they're not necessarily out at practice. So the coach is typically the first person on the scene in both settings that we found. And so you look at the differences in training between the two, you got 99% of the high school coaches having CPR first aid training compared to just 1 in 3 club coaches. And you can kind of see the huge issues that would arise if you have a club athlete with a serious injury and the coach is the one that has to provide immediate care.
So one of the things I think is really great about this research is that it's not just doing research for the sake of doing research and getting the publication. Is there's a lot of actionable items in this and things that you can do and ways you can make a difference in patient outcomes. So sort of as you think about this project as a whole, what are the next steps in it? Not necessarily research wise, but for how do we make sports safer and how do you use this data to advocate for patients?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, there's been a lot of great work done in our field about pushing for greater youth sports safety at the high school level, at the secondary school level. And that's absolutely necessary, right? And a great step. But I think it's just a first step, like you said. Really, the push needs to be to push for proper medical coverage in terms of athletic trainers and push for higher standards of emergency preparedness and training in the club sports setting as well. We've got this huge patient population that is not necessarily being addressed at this point. And if we've decided that athletic trainers are necessary at the secondary school level, well, we have this huge proportion of them that are also participating in the club sports setting that's not regulated. So when we talk to high school athletic trainers, they'll say, these kids go to these club tournaments all weekend, they get injured, then they come to us at the high school setting, and we're providing care for those injuries that are sustained, that they're in another setting, essentially. So when we're thinking about talking about appropriate medical care, emergency preparedness, it's not just about the secondary school. It's about adolescent athletes, youth athletes overall, right? These kids are not just contained within this high school sports bubble and that's all that they do. They participate across a wide range of settings, and we need to make sure that they're participating safely across all those different settings. And so pushing for athletic trainers in the club sports setting, supporting, greater training and emergency preparedness in the club sports setting and trying to highlight that issue, I think, is really important. There's an inter-association task force document on best practices for youth sports league provided by NATA from 2017. And that's a great starting point. I think, we kind of need to shift our mindset from thinking just about the secondary school setting to kind of that wider youth sport lens that a lot of these kids are participating in.
So I think there's a big opportunity for us as individual athletic trainers and as a profession to use this research that is coming out and in the special issue of really advancing sports safety. So can you provide maybe 2 to 3 specific talking points that can be used when you're talking with coaches and parents about sports specialization? Because I imagine there's some resistance, particularly in coaches. And I know when in the parents that I've interacted with, because they have these ideas of the benefits. So can you give us some specific language that can be used and taken back into our own clinical practices?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to try to dispel the myths that surround sports specialization. So the fact that early sports specialization is not necessary for elite sports success. You know, so if you can find examples within your local sports community, and that can be statewide, that can be national examples, or it can be community examples of, you know, elite athletes that have come from your area or are very popular in your state, use those examples of elite athletes that did not specialize early to help dispel that myth. That early specialization is necessary for elite sports success. You can find people that you can point to examples that, you know, they delay specialization until mid to late adolescence, and they're still able to participate at the highest level and reach elite levels. Because I think a lot of that mindset for parents and kids comes from that desire to want to be somebody who makes it to that elite level. So, you know, being able to find an example, find multiple examples, it won't be hard because it's kind of the typical path towards success, but find examples that are tailored to your specific area that will speak to the kids and to the parents in your area that dispel some of those myths around specialization. And then for parents, I would say one thing you can do is try to monitor your child's organized sport participation volume. So just try adding up the number of hours they spend per week on one of their organized sports and see you know, what that number comes out to. One of the guidelines that exists is not to participate in a single organized sport more hours per week than your age. And so this can be a simple tool that parents can use just to try to see if their child is participating in what could potentially be an excessive amount of organized sport in a single sport that could lead to overuse injury.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today about your article and sports specialization overall. Before we finish, I want to give you a minute to give us 1 or 2 take-home points and how this information can be used to help with improving patient outcomes.
Yeah, so there's some specific recommendations that have been developed. You know, one of those would be to try to encourage as much as possible unorganized sport activity. So actually just playing, okay? No, you know, coaches needed, no referees needed, but just supporting play and finding ways to support that within your local community, or if you're an athletic trainer with kids, supporting that within your own children, right? More opportunities of unorganized sport activity as opposed to everything needing to be some sort of organized sport. Other recommendations involve taking 2 to 3 months off per year from organized sport activity. So it doesn't have to be at one time, but making sure you're scheduling breaks from organized single sport activity. So to build in breaks throughout the year where kids have more opportunities to participate in unorganized play, neighborhood play, things like that. And then, like I talked about, there's a recommendation not to participate in any more hours per week of organized sport activity than the athlete's age. So if you have a 16-year-old daughter, then just encourage her not to participate in more than 16 hours per week of volleyball or whatever her, you know, chosen sport might be. And then specific to the club sport setting, like I talked about, I think we need to think as a profession about pushing for, you know, ways that we can push for stronger adherence to emergency preparedness standards and medical coverage standards in the club sport setting, because I think that setting is only continuing to grow and we're just having a larger and larger proportion of kids that are participating in the club sport setting either on top of their high school sport participation or choosing to participate in club sports instead of high school sports.
Well, thank you for those, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. I really appreciate your time and also the commitment that you've made to improving patient outcomes and for the profession of athletic training. So thanks for being here, and I hope you have a great day.
Perfect. Thanks, Lizzie.
I hope you all found this podcast informative and that you can utilize the clinical recommendations to improve patient care. That's it for today's The AT Tapes. Please remember to rate and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Also, please follow the Journal of Athletic Training on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at JAT_NATA on all 3 platforms. Thank you for listening, and I hope you will join us for next month's episode of the AT Tapes.